Welcome to Podcasting Tech, a podcast for busy entrepreneurs who want professional sound and appearance for their content creation. I'm Matthew Passi, your host, and a 15-year veteran in the podcasting industry. In this show, we interview podcasters and content creators to learn about the technology they use to make their shows sound and look amazing. We also connect with the people who develop software solutions to highlight the latest and simply greatest tools out there to help you be successful. Head on over to podcastingtech.com, where you can subscribe to the show on YouTube or your favorite podcasting platform, and join us on this exciting journey to unlock the full potential of your podcast.
Welcome to Something in Media, a show that tells the story of successful people in the general world of media and what it takes to make it to the very top. I'm Dave Maguire. We plan to show you that there are many ways to become successful in the world of media, whatever your background and wherever you're from. In this episode, we welcome writer and podcast sensation Jamie Morton onto the show as we talk about how he turned his love for performance into his superpower and how creating the world's most successful podcast is only the start for him.
I think episode 3 was when Elijah Wood tweeted about it and we were like, oh, people are listening to this elsewhere. It sounds so naive. But also podcasting, as you say, it just wasn't what it is now.
As you'll hear, Jamie didn't listen much to the naysayers at school and he found his passion for storytelling early on. Encouraged by his parents, Jamie cut his teeth creating student television at Leeds University before hitting some bumps in the road, facing the realities of life lived in London, working for an internet TV series that was way before its time, and being sent on jobs that were barely paying him enough to survive. However, despite these years of hardship, Jamie has persisted and created a hit podcast with many millions of listeners around the world. According to Jamie, it's all about timing. With that in mind, I started off by asking Jamie how he would describe his current job title.
Because I suppose now that my dad wrote a porno's ended, I'm not a podcaster anymore, but even that felt woolly. Not really a job yet. Hopefully one day it'll be a proper, respected job in the industry. So, I mean, I guess I'm still a writer, producer, director, podcaster. I mean, I'm not anything, am I?
You're a triple threat, quadruple threat.
What's that thing? A jack of all trades, master of none. That's definitely me.
You're putting yourself down because, you know, you had one of the biggest hits in podcasting ever, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a surprise hit. I don't think anyone saw it coming, least of all me.
Was it really? Come on. In terms of, even when you're doing it.
Well, it's interesting. People ask me that a lot. And I think what it was that I always thought it was good and funny, if I'm allowed to say that. But that doesn't mean that it's going to be successful. Those two things are not, you know, they're very rarely connected, actually, as we all know. Because I've got friends who've been making incredible stuff for years that hasn't taken off the way that my dad wrote a porno did. So I feel very lucky that we had that initial success that we were able to kind of build upon. I mean, it's a very niche thing when you think about it. It's my dad's dodgy erotica that I'm reading to my two best mates. There was a chance of it being incredibly insular and actually quite alienating to a wider audience. So I think when we were prepping the show and developing it up, because we spent about a year developing it before we started recording, we talked a lot about that. Like, you know, let's make sure that we break down as many barriers of entry as possible, and we were very careful about not just little things like talking about other friends that we have if people don't know them. Anything that made us seem like we were just like a bit of a clique chatting, we tried to kind of wash all that away as much as possible.
I think people listening will find that really interesting, that those were conscious decisions and a year planning. I mean, my God, it didn't just happen.
It wasn't like every day. We weren't like, how the hell are we going to make this? But yeah, because I think as well, you can have an idea, but I think it is important to let that idea percolate and let it kind of develop. And especially with something like podcasting, which was so new and also so, with this idea, so potentially not dodgy, but I think it had to be handled in the right way, given the pornography of it all. And I think just as we kind of properly began developing it, we really found the show. Because I think what you don't want to do is create a podcast and just put your first episode out and then let the show find its feet over the first 10, 20 episodes, because your first stuff is the most important stuff, particularly in podcasting. So if you don't kind of start, you know, hitting the ground running, I think you can kind of maybe never get to that point where your show's taking flight. So we were quite aware of that and wanted to make sure that it was kind of the complete show from the word go.
It absolutely does. And people have a limited amount of time to spend their leisure time. Podcasting,
yeah, absolutely.
Being, you know, competing not just with other podcasts, but with Netflix, their TV, etc.
Everything. And, yeah, there's so much stuff to consume.
You lose them.
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting point. But let's start with, if I may, with your childhood. So you're from Manchester, is that right?
Manchester, yeah.
My research is correct.
Yeah. Can you not tell by my really uneven accent? Sometimes there's a long A, sometimes I haven't been able to cover it. Yes, grew up in Manchester. For the first 18 years of my life, then I went to university in Leeds and then ditched the north and moved down to London to become a twat. I had a great childhood growing up in Manchester. It was fun.
Yeah, tell me about your household. You one of several brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I've got three sisters, which was fun. Girls can be very cruel when they're in a pack, which I learned to my detriment. I was a second eldest, which kind of gave me a bit of clout within the household, but not much really. And yeah, my parents were very, I guess because there were six of us, we were kind of a bit of a rabble, but they were also quite unorthodox parents. Like they were mavericks.
Still are.
Well, quite. I mean, yeah, this was all seeded very early. And they were viewed with a certain amount of skepticism, I think, in the town that we lived, that they were just a little bit, they did things their own way, but I think in a brilliant way.
And so your dad's Irish, is that right? Is your mum also Irish too? So
my mum isn't, but her whole family is Irish, but she was born in Middlesbrough.
When you go up, do you find yourself like changing it to a northern twang, or is
not
it kind
really.
Of mellowed out?
I mean, I don't go up that much because my parents don't live up there anymore. All of my sisters and myself moved to London, and then I'm the only one that stayed. But they all have stayed down south, so my parents decided to move as well because there wasn't really much for them up there anymore. I mean, once your kids leave, it's kind of like you want to be close to them, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. I can 100% empathise with that, being in your situation. But with your kind of sisters and your, let's say, unorthodox parents... You've obviously got a love of creativity, and sorry, I know you laughed about it. I didn't mean to offend.
No, it's funny because I'm just like, what's the right word to describe them? I mean, that's as good as any, I think.
Batshit. I mean, yeah, the mystery that surrounds your dad, especially, like, you know, he's this figure who he's obviously a character, and he sounds brilliant. But you know, you're a creative person now, and you obviously thrive off being creative and coming up with ideas, which we'll get to. Do you think on a some kind of level that you picked up that personality trait from them being in that environment? Was your dad in media or doing something creative?
No, I mean, I think this is what's really interesting. My parents were very just open for us to be our authentic selves, which I'm really grateful for, actually, because my mum was a teacher, my dad was a builder. They weren't from, and he owned a garage as well, like a mechanics. So they weren't creative in of themselves, certainly in their day jobs, but they were very much... I think they saw that me and my elder sister particularly, we were very kind of creative and we were very into the arts and theatre and stuff. So they really, they really encouraged that in us, I think, which, you know, was again kind of unusual, particularly for me as the boy. Like, I think a lot of people were like, he should just be playing football and stuff. And they were like, well, no, he's into this sort of stuff. Let him do it, which I'm so grateful for, because in a way, them allowing me to be myself and creative at that young age has kind of come full circle for them, and now my dad's benefited from me being able to help turn his book into what it's become. So it's nice.
Absolutely, it's a nice story to tell.
It's nice to think that, you know, if you just let your kids be themselves, it'll come back to you in some way, you know, even if it's just that your kids are happy, a happy adult, you know.
Yeah, so we're talking late 80s, 90s,
like the 90s,
up. What kind of thing were you doing in terms of being creative as a kid? am I right? Because I heard somewhere that you were involved in plays and things, even at school, is that right?
Not at school, there was no creativity at the schools that I went to, but there was a kind of old theatre. Alice and James have ripped that. I mean, they have had so much fun with this. There was an old theatre called the Club Theatre. I think it's now called the Little Theatre in South Manchester. And I used to go there every Saturday and, like, just hang out at this theatre with, like, these old, amazing old actors and with, like, some friends and my sister and stuff. And we'd, like, put on plays. Like, I wrote a lot of plays. I directed loads of plays and I acted in some stuff as well. And it was just the most amazingly creative thing to do on a weekend, and for me it was so normal. But then as I've kind of shared this to people. People are like, you hung out with 80-year-olds when you were like 10.
I suppose it's that thing of like, that sounds great. But it's that unorthodox is what I keep on coming back to. And but you were allowed to do that. How old were you, roughly?
I think I started when I was like 7, and I went through until a worryingly late age, maybe like 15.
But you enjoyed it.
I loved it,
yeah.
I did it with my mates. It wasn't like I was on my own there. Yeah, I mean, and you know, I think if you are a creative person, there's nothing better than being in a space that piques your creativity. You know, being in an old theatre with so much history and I just love theatres. It's one of the things that I've loved the most when we've done our tours. It's just being in these old theatres all over the world and hearing the stories about them and who's played on these stages. I just love all of that.
Fantastic. Capturing your imagination gets you excited, I suppose. Gets you motivated for doing things. I read that you didn't really enjoy school that much. I think you said something like you were considered an oddball, in your words, at school. So was that like a nice counterpunch to...
I think it was why I was just an oddball, actually. I think I should have conformed way sooner. But yeah, I think so. I think it was just... I think some people respond to school and that kind of social structure and hierarchy, or they don't. And I was always quite, like, weirdly kind of stubborn about not fitting in. Like, I didn't want to kind of modulate myself into being just another person that could get through school unscathed. And so I was pretty badly bullied, but it didn't oddly really bother me that much. I guess because I had the benefit of... as we both did, growing up before there was social media, and you know, school did end at 3:30, and you could have another life after it until the next day. It was hard, but I almost blame myself as much as the people that bullied me, because I probably would have bullied me. I was just an easy target, you know, and I think you can't really hold on to that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. It was fine.
Yeah, but it's nice that you had not just a creative outlet, an outlet to express yourself. And that kind of, I suppose, helped formed who you are today, and it got you some kind of confidence to then, when you move down to London, kind of think to yourself, oh, I can do this.
I think it toughens you up for sure. And I think it's also helpful to live your life a little bit outside the norm. I think being an observer is such an important part of being a creative person, being an artist, being someone that has something to say on the world, you know. And so I think that is actually kind of an important component of my life, to kind of not always have felt the most involved or to fit in, really. I think that actually is oddly quite a good thing.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of like, I suppose, being a producer versus being quote-unquote the star of something, a presenter, you know, an actor, I may be connecting dots that don't need connecting, but this idea that, you know, you're also creating the content is just as important, maybe more important than just having the exposure, the fame element of being in media, of being in television, being on stage.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I've never really been one for the being in it, the kind of the talent side of it. I actually actively don't like it, and I'm only in My Dad Wrote a Porno because I had to be, because it's my dad. It couldn't really have been done without me being a part of it in that way. But I'm actually really looking forward to not being in that sort of role anymore, because I take all of my enjoyment from the process of creating stuff. And like, even with My Dad Wrote a Porno, my favorite part was editing the episodes.
Really?
And
that's,
I was on my own and kind of crafting it and building it, and I love that. That's exactly what I'm in it for. Like, in fact, somebody said to me, like, kind of recently, maybe like a couple of years ago, they were like, you can afford to get an editor for this, why are you still editing it? And I said, that's literally why I do it. I wouldn't trust anyone else to do that, because it's the most important part of the process, but also that's the part that I enjoy the most. So that's why I'm here doing it. It's to make stuff, not just to be in stuff.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think a lot of people, obviously, they have different reasons for getting into, you know, podcasting might be one, but television. And it depends on which industry you go in, but there's the element of control varies, shall we say. Yeah. Podcasting being really
absolute
one end of the spectrum.
Control.
Maybe... Yeah. Television being at the other, perhaps films.
Yeah, I mean, well, anything that I mean, I guess I think the general rule is the more people that it takes to make something, the less control you have, right? Podcasting is so intimate. I mean, look at us right here, right now. You know, you brought some stuff in, we set it up, we're talking, and this is it. You know, So maybe I am a control freak. Maybe that's what it is. But I mean, I love collaborating with people as well. And, you know, I'm writing a couple of things at the minute with people, which is really fun as well. But for me, it just was never about being in stuff. It just was, it sounds awful, but it did, that sort of side of it just did happen.
Mm.
And once you have a hit with something, you know, you want to honor it. You want to make the most of it. You want to kind of squeeze it dry. And I feel like with My Dad Wrote a Porno, it's such a stupid thing to have happened that I've, you know, performed at the Sydney Opera House and Radio City Music Hall and the Royal Albert Hall. It's just stupid.
Like a rock star.
It's just, well, it's just ridiculous. And I kind of loved the fact that that's in my past now. It's like, oh yeah, I used to tour the world. That's a weird thing that I used to do. And I'm quite excited about this new stage of my career when I'm back to doing kind of where I'm more comfortable. And because there's a lot of pressure that comes with being in something, and particularly with a show that had the profile that we did, and, you know, doing stuff in America and our HBO show being kind of the biggest thing that we did, that was just terrifying for me to be suddenly, having had no experience of being on-screen talent at all, and I'm hosting my own hour-long comedy special on HBO. I mean, really scary.
Well, we'll come to this in a minute, but one of my questions, which I might as well ask now, is, you know, what you just listed, was there ever a pinch me moment? I mean, or 'cause I've talked to people who have had fame and success in the past, and strangely, the answer is usually no, and it's only usually after the fact. Is that true for you?
I kind of. I mean, I don't know. I think because My Dad Wrote a Porno happened so quickly, I was living my life, and then we made this show, and the minute it came out, it kind of began to make waves really quite quickly. There wasn't much of an adjustment time, really. I remember, in fact, being on the tube going to work and just reading the Metro, and I turned the page and my face was in the Metro and it was like, pick of the week, this podcast. And I was like, it freaked me the hell out. I actually got off the tube.
Did you have that moment?
I felt really embarrassed.
You got off the tube?
Just off the, like at the station, just to be like, I didn't want people to see that I was reading it. I don't know. I just, it felt really odd to me. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what I mean.
It was,
I don't,
just an
I can't,
odd thing to,
I've
kind of,
I've never been there myself, but it must have been very strange.
Yeah, just be confronted with that. And because I had no idea it was, I don't know. So that was a bit of a, oh, this is becoming a thing. But yeah.
If it was a comedy sketch, there would be somebody sat opposite you with the same paper, just slowly looking up and then doing a double take.
And being like, oh, look, he's reading about himself. What a freak.
But that, I would say that's 9 times out of 10, they wouldn't be thinking that. They'd be thinking, oh, amazing, brilliant. My God, this famous.
Let's put me in perspective. I'm not, you know, Tom Holland on the tube, but yeah.
Actually, one of my questions was about that Metro article, because I remember reading that and feeling, so I've listened from the very beginning, because working in podcasts, and what I liked about it at first was like, finally something that's new and not just a formulaic interview show,
right?
Or a kind of comedian talking about themselves, you know, it's something that is genuinely different.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't punch down, and it's it has personality in bucket loads, and it's just something that you can talk to your friends about, because it's like, it's entertaining, but it's also shocking in a nice way. You know what I mean? It's just this really fantastic thing. And that working in podcasts and audio myself at the time, it was almost unique to see something about podcasting in the mainstream press.
Yeah, I agree. It was the first time that it kind of, I mean, I guess like the Ricky Gervais show had that maybe 10 years before in that first wave of podcasting. And then podcasting is kind of like hibernated for a while, didn't it? Kind of, it was still going on, but it didn't really have the spotlight on it or whatever. And then I think our show was kind of maybe the next one that kind of did break out in that way into the wider culture.
For me, it was just fantastic to see, especially from people who are based in the UK. Again, you know, Ricky Gervais being maybe an exception, but all that thing with Serial, a very American kind of led industry.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question, it's just congratulations.
Oh, thanks.
going back to your childhood and school. Mm. So after school, A-levels.
Yeah.
And was there a plan at that point? Did you have a career in mind, or was it just something that you were still figuring out?
I always knew that I wanted to tell stories, and I've never really been cared about the way I've gone about that. You know, I was never kind of, I want to make movies, or I want to make television, or I want to write books or write plays. Whereas a lot of my friends were kind of very set on a specific medium. But the wider kind of media industry, certainly in London, that was always my aim, to come down to London for sure.
Right.
Because it was kind of before Manchester has... Now it's become such an amazing hub for that sort of stuff, which it wasn't when I was a kid. So maybe if I'd have been growing up there now, I wouldn't have needed to come to London. But London kind of was still very much that place that mm-hmm. you wanted to go if you wanted to... you know, succeed in this business.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like, obviously, you went to college to do, or did you stay at the same school to do A-levels?
Same school, A-levels, yeah.
Were you still kind of dabbling, hanging out on a weekend with the...
Not during my A-levels. I think I kind of discovered actual socialising and going out and underage drinking and all of that sort of stuff. So,
yeah,
that kind of took precedence at that point in my life, yeah.
So you're saying you wanted to tell stories. Were you trying to do that in your spare time as well?
No, because it wasn't even that specific that I wanted to do that sort of stuff. I mean, I guess I just was concentrating on getting out of Manchester, to be honest, and kind of getting my A-levels so that I could get to university, because I really wanted to go to Leeds. That was a really important place. And I think if I hadn't have got into Leeds, I probably wouldn't have gone to university, and I would have just moved down to London and tried to kind of, you know, break in some way.
What did you do at university? What was the course?
It doesn't exist anymore, actually, but it was photography and cinema. Very theory-based, quite technical. It wasn't really, this is kind of embarrassing to admit, but it wasn't really the course. I wanted to be part of the Leeds student TV station because it was kind of renowned as like the best student TV station. It was set up by amongst other people, Ben Winston, who he's a bit older than me. So I'd heard about this student TV station, and it just seemed like the most amazing thing. You could just for free make whatever you wanted, and you had all of this free time at university. And I had a lot of free time.
Well, you do as a student. So how did you find out about the TV show then? Was it just researching?
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was when I was looking at universities, I was kind of... My mum was very good about... I was going to do politics and history because that's what my A-levels were in, and English Lit. But my mum was like, you don't want to do that. Again, my parents being amazingly insightful about who I was. And she was like... I remember her sitting me down and she was like, you don't want to do history and politics. I mean, you like that. Great. But you don't want to be studying that. You want to be more creative. You want to do something that's like more you. And so, because I never even thought that I could do something like that at university. I probably thought that my parents wouldn't approve, actually, of something, quote unquote, Mickey Mouse degree, you know. And so I was kind of like, well, I want to go to like a good university, like a red brick. And I wanted to kind of, seeing as I'm going to be there, I want to use that time to be as creative as possible if I'm now going to commit to that. And so I was looking at about what societies each university had, and I saw that Leeds Student TV was this amazing resource. And it's where I met all of my friends, pretty much, from university. I mean, a few from my course that I'm still mates with, but most of my friends are all from LSTV, and they're all doing insanely amazing things now.
So was it just like a proper studio setup with cameras and things? Was it?
It was a cupboard underneath the stairs of the University Union. It was so small. You could maybe fit 4 people in there at a time. We managed to fit 10 to 15 for a live broadcast that James Cooper was the host of every week. So each week people could just make shows, and it was strung together by presenters.
What was the show James made or presented?
So James actually hosted it with with our friend Lucy Cherniak, who's now a big director in America. She directed some of Station 11. Like, she's an amazing director. So Lucy and James were hosts of this live broadcast, basically, from this cupboard in the Union, that they would just throw to different programmes that people had made throughout. I mean, it was terrible.
Where was it broadcast, by the way?
Around the Union.
Right.
So completely pointless. And people would just be like, will you switch that off? Because the sound was terrible. Like, people are like drinking in Old Borough or whatever, and they're like, oh my God, what is that racket? Oh yeah, it's a Wednesday at 2 o'clock. It's that weird show that those freaks are making. But yeah, it's where I'm at. Alice, James, all of my friends.
Fantastic. Yeah, because a lot of people, well, especially, I don't know if it's the same in media, you know, university, the social element and getting your hands dirty, at least initially, for that first kind of taste of what it's like to make something professional. You know, obviously a lot of people don't go to university, but some of them would go on to be as equally successful you know, world famous.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's interesting. Like, my housemate in Leeds, a guy called Alex, he was a bit older than me. He'd been to university before, and he was kind of, we did the same course, actually, as well as at LSTV. And he said to me, he was maybe like 10 years older than me. And he said to me one day, he was like, Jamie, you'll never have as much free time in your life as you are in these 3 years. We should really make the most of that. And yeah, he's now like an executive at Lionsgate and stuff.
It's a wise thing for an 18-year-old to say.
I mean, he was like 26, seven. So he was older than me, but still quite wise.
Still, I mean, even...
if only he knew what my life would become. Turns out I've had a lot of free time being out of work for most of my 20s. Yeah. But he was right. And it was like one of these, those amazing kind of, yeah, light bulb moments of, this is a great opportunity. You're with so many hungry, young, creative people. Let's just make stuff and fail and be rubbish and hopefully over 3 years get a bit better. And what was really brilliant about LSTV was that you became friends with people in the years above you, so that when they left and graduated and they got their starts in London, by the time you were graduating, they were kind of at a point in their careers where they could be hiring runners and assistants and people that they needed for shoots. So it was actually a really great way to kind of get into the industry properly as well, because you suddenly had contacts that you... Because, I mean, my family, I mean, my parents had... We knew nobody. So that was kind of a really important part of it as well, to kind of get to meet people that could then help you get into the industry when you graduated.
Having the exposure. And so at that point, are you talking about maybe mid-2000s?
Yeah, I went to university, started in 2005.
Yeah. And so would you say that period, 2005 to, let's say, 2010... was that like kind of the start of your kind of creative period? Because you know, you talked about being bullied at school. I assume confidence was relatively low. This seems like the end of the story.
Really. That's the weird thing about me. Is that
please tell
it
me.
Didn't really affect my confidence because I didn't really care what they thought. It was an odd kind of environment because it kind of just made me think, sure,
right.
Okay. You'll be doing what you'll be doing, and I'll be doing what I'll be doing, and we'll see who wins in 40 years.
Well, again, that you seem to have an element of perspective, which seems to be quite rare, which is a great quality to have, but then only kind of perpetuated you from university, it sounds like, because suddenly you had all these means at your disposal to make things, and you didn't have this kind of element of, like, group of trying to suppress you and what you wanted to do. And
yeah, and I think, you know, being friends with so many people that wanted to do what you wanted to do as well, we just supported each other through that time. And because you know, when I moved to London, it was pretty tough. I got a job quite quickly with
Alex. So was it straight away after university, or do you...
my lecturer actually at university was making his own film, and he asked me to be the director of photography on that when I graduated, which was amazing. So we shot that in Paris.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. And we wrapped that kind of maybe around about the autumn time. And that's when I moved to London, like September, October time. What,
excuse my ignorance, but what does that mean, director of photography, when you're...
Camera, lighting. Okay. I mean, stuff that I'm actually not very good at now. But back then, I had a kind of passion for it. And my dissertation, I kind of concentrated on that. So he was like, oh, that's... You can do that.
That must have given you a bit of a boost.
I mean, free labour. It wasn't like...
That's another way of looking at
it. He was like, oh, who's like half decent and can be here for free? Oh, yeah, Jamie will do it. But no, yeah, it was a great vote of confidence from him, for sure. And then I moved to London and got a job with Alice and James, actually, weirdly. And then and that was... I kind of had this job for about a year, and then everything kind of fell apart. That job got... The show got cancelled.
You're working for a company that was subcontracted to Bebo, is that right?
So it was a production company called RDF who were making a magazine show for Bebo, which was a social network back in the day.
I remember it.
Do you? You see?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Pre Facebook, almost
everything, MySpace, pretty maybe. Much, yeah. And they were so forward thinking. They had all these original shows. So they had this show called Sam King, which is about this guy who, like, this young kid who started his own record label, and Sophia's Diary about this girl who, I guess, wrote a diary. I don't know. I didn't watch these shows, but they were kind of like they were dramas on this social network. So it was kind of the first time that was really being done. And we, Alice, James, and I, we made a show called Bebox for them. Alice and James hosted it. I filmed it and edited it. And yeah, we did that for like 9 months. But then, I think AOL bought Bebo and shut down their original content arm with such foresight. I mean, you know, who'd have thought that had a future? And so then our show was going to come back for season two, and we were on hiatus, and I was actually directing a short film that I'd written, thinking, oh great, I've got a job to go to after this. And then I got a phone call to say, yeah, there's no budget, they've kind of slashed everything. And then I just had a pretty difficult like 3 years just kind of trying to
find my way. What was your living circumstances in London? Because if you're not from a wealthy background and you're not from a family that are based in London, it can be tough, can't it? Because you know, you're maybe couch surfing, or you're living in very crammed.
For the first housing. Like I moved to London literally with a suitcase, and I just stayed on floors of people that I met through LSTV, actually.
Right.
Like my friends Lucy and Jen, they were amazing. They were so sweet. They gave me one of their beds in their house and they shared their bed. I was like, God, you're so sweet. And then I moved into just like a massive house share. There were like seven of us. James was one of them.
Whereabouts in London was that?
I've lived all over. My first place was in Honor Oak Park. Then we moved to Tooting. Then the Isle of Dogs.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Cheaper.
Is it? Okay.
Well, it was then. I don't know. I mean, it was very residential. We were like, what are we doing here? We were this rabble of like, seven of us in this tiny little house. Everyone around us must have hated us. And then, Stratford for a long time. Then I lived in Islington. Yes, I've kind of lived all over the place. But that was fun. You know, when you're in your 20s, it was... I had a great time. You know, I really struggled with work, but... And I did have a bit of depression at that time as well. But generally speaking, it was fun. And I met my writing partner really early, a guy called Tom Wackett, who I'm still working with now. We're developing a new show at the minute, actually. So, it was a really creative time, but it was not the best work, you know. Mm-hmm. Earning money was kind of tough. But
So, like, the difference from university, where I'm not saying it's an idealistic world at uni, because you know
it 100%
is. You have digs and you have this kind of picture of the industry, if I can call it that, and you have pictures of like my lifestyle. You know, I'm going to live in a leafy suburb and kind of create projects that I'm you know, going to be global hits. And then when you start couch surfing and you start kind of at the bottom rung of I don't know, the TV industry or wherever you work, you kind of realize that you then have to earn the right to move up a level, and it can be quite... We say you had a bit of depression. Was that the reality of what the real world was like? Or was am I misreading that?
There was a combination of things, as you know. Obviously, it wasn't just one thing. But like, I think because I moved to London and I got this job that I really enjoyed and I made loads of friends, I kind of had this false start. Mm-hmm. And then it all got kind of pulled away. And then, because I'd been working in digital content, which was so new and innovative at that time. We're talking like 2008.
Yeah. You say digital content in 2008 to somebody and people kind of go, advertising? Or, you know?
Honestly, they just didn't understand. And then, because I hadn't worked in proper telly, quote unquote, no one would hire me for those jobs. So I had to kind of find work in digital content that just wasn't being created.
Yeah.
And so actually it was our generation that kind of started all of that stuff. And I, you know, I worked on the first ever magazine show for Facebook called Unlimited back in the day. And
what was that about, that show?
It was kind of like This Morning, but amazing. For like young people, like young people's stories.
Yeah.
And I mean, I worked on just so many.
And was
weird
that just reaching out to people, asking the question, "Do you need somebody to do this?"
Yeah, completely. Kind of and I would just, you know, I would just do odd days shooting, like jobs. I remember being asked to go and film the signage at Camberley Shopping Centre for a brand, and I was like, "Sure," and it like paid like £100, and I had to hire a camera and get to Camberley and back. It's like after, you know, I think I may have made £20 on jobs like that. I once had to go and film something like one of the kids from Outnumbered had to, maybe they were nominated for an award or something, and they had to like deliver a acceptance speech that was going to be a remote thing. So I had to go to their house in the middle of nowhere and film that. And just like weird, odd jobs, you know? Yeah.
But is it a true freelance then?
So I've always been a freelancer. I've never had a real job.
And so I heard a story that you were with your writer friend, Tom.
Yeah.
And you got a call to do a project that featured somebody that you really admired.
Yeah.
You did the job, got fired from it.
Yes.
Obviously a traumatic experience.
Thanks. Yes.
But my point being is that as a freelancer, do you feel that you became better at it? because of going through those things.
100%. And it's one of those things that I remember just thinking, really, and I do a lot of talks at my old university, Leeds, about working in the industry. And something that I say to the young students is that, like, when you're in the middle of your hardest period of your career, and you feel like you're taking a massive step backwards and you're not achieving anything and you're kind of frustrated, it's easy to think that you're not growing or that you're not learning anything. But actually, you need to go through all of that to then be ready to do the stuff that is going to make you successful later on. Like with me specifically, you know, all of the skills that I was learning through those really hard years became the things that I needed to create My Dad Wrote a Porno and to keep the control of that show between me, James, and Alice. You know, you have to kind of go through all of that stuff to be ready for the opportunities when they arrive later on in your career. And I think I wish I'd have had a better perspective of that when I was young. Like,
it's so difficult to have that perspective when you're in it. And, you know, you have
all these... Because it's bleak. And it's really hard, actually. And it is weirdly, not triggering thinking about it, but I forget how hard it was. It really was difficult. But ultimately, as you say, I learned so much in that time that I just wouldn't have learned otherwise, you know.
Welcome back. This is Something in Media. I'm Dave Maguire. And we're listening to the story of how Jamie Morton became one of the most recognised voices in the world. So we've heard Jamie's background, but I wanted to ask him which experience pre-porno resonated with him the most.
Can I ask you a question? Before porno and the trajectory to where you are today, what was your favourite thing you did?
Job?
Pre-porno, yeah.
Oh my God, that's a good question. I mean, As I got older, things I began to have pretty good jobs. I directed and edited a lot of documentaries for Vice, which I loved doing. I used to write. I created with James, actually, for The Apprentice, this thing on iPlayer where we would basically take the piss out of the contestants each week by kind of creating a little thing called Honest Subtitles, where we'd basically write what
that
they
was
all
great.
Thought they were really saying. And I did that for years. I loved that job.
That was my favourite bit of The whole Apprentice.
So, oh, thanks.
Kudos to you for that. That's
yeah, brilliant. It was fun.
Very funny.
Thanks. It was, I mean, yeah, compliance was a nightmare. We'd be like, can we say this in the BBC? We're like, no, can't say that. And it just became quite, it was an oddly hard thing to do because obviously you wanted to keep pushing the boundaries and they were like, well, we can't, you know, take the piss out of them too much. I'm like, no, I know, sorry. But that was a fun job. I had loads of fun jobs, to be honest with you. I have been very lucky, you know, as much as I haven't worked consistently or didn't for a long time, you know, 3 or 4 years into my career, I started to kind of work more consistently. And I think that just happens, you know, you just get better and you get more contacts. And like you say, you know, having tough experiences like being let go from a job, actually, it was great for me because it made me really analyze what I was doing wrong and why that happened. And actually, there was a load of stuff as to why that happened that wasn't really to do with me anyway. But it is important to kind of go through that self-reflection, especially when you're a freelancer, because you know, every day is your first day at work. You know, you don't really have the luxury of having an off day or, you know, being a bit hungover today, I'm not going to really bother. You know, you have to kind of bring it every day because someone's paying for you by, you know, sometimes by the hour or certainly by the day. So you really owe it to whoever's employing you to be your best self. So that's good training, I think. And then when it came to working for myself with My Dad Wrote a Porno, I was used to kind of that way of working, so it wasn't a hardship for me, really.
When you were in that period, we'll get to kind of launching My Dad Wrote a Porno after this, but were you looking at other people that maybe you're at university with, or people that are the same age as you, with envy? You're kind of looking at someone like, I wish I was, if only I had the opportunity, or were you kind of focused on what you were doing and carving your own path?
I wasn't, not envious, because I think what's great about our industry is that you can't do what anybody else does, so there's no point in being envious. I mean, I was really proud of all of my friends, and also, you know, they're your friends. Like, why wouldn't you be super proud of them? I remember when James was nominated for his BAFTA, I was like, my God, like, we were kids together and you've been nominated for a BAFTA for a show that you've created. That's so cool.
I think that's a really nice point, that there might be a certain element of whisperers that once you get into a certain position, not backstabbing, that's too strong a word, but this kind of that competitive element. I've certainly found it in podcasting where it's kind of, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats and all that kind of malarkey. But it's nice that it's true. You know, people do support each other.
I think it is true. And I think, you know, especially it comes back to being a creative person, you know, all you can do is see the world through your lens, you know, and your perspective. And that is your toolkit, right? So no one else can do that. So I feel being jealous of other people's success is so counterproductive to what we all do for a living. You should be doing something else, like being, you know, the city, if you're going to be that sort of kind of competitive, because, you know, that's the sort of industry that will, that mentality will help you rise and it will make you better, probably. I mean, you can probably tell I have never worked in the city and probably I'm very wrong about them, or I'm sure they're lovely people.
But like, briefcase now.
Yeah. But yeah, I just think, you know, your individuality is what is celebrated in this industry. And in most industries, that's what's kind of not the most useful component of your.
I mention it, I suppose, just because of the social media element of, you know, people only post stuff that makes them look
good. That I have fewer followers than James and Alex, is that what you're
saying? That's my main point, yes. And you should be ashamed of yourself. Get out. No.
Yeah.
This idea that, you know, people only post their success. And, you know, LinkedIn is a good example of that. Facebook, not Bieber anymore. Does it exist? I don't know.
I don't know. I heard rumours that they're bringing it back.
Yeah. If they need a...
I may need the work, so I'm all for it.
But yeah, it's that kind of thing of like, don't take everything at face value. And I think that what you said is good.
Everything's like that, isn't it? Mm. You know, I think we're getting way more wise to that as a culture, which is good.
Yeah. So My Dad Wrote a Porno, you were 27 when it started.
Yeah, I was. Which kind of makes me think, Jamie, get over yourself. I was like, I found it so hard. You were 27. You were pretty young when this all kind of happened for you.
You'd already gone through a lot at that point anyway. You know, you've taken a big leap. You've had some experience under your belt and you had the confidence to launch something like this and to see the potential.
Yeah.
And I think at 27, I know I thought I was older than I was. I remember people saying, you're only 27. Me thinking, I'm 27. But still, that's an incredible achievement for someone that young.
I think 27 was a really weird age for me. My life, I don't know if this is true for everyone, but my life kind of shifted at 27. I don't know why. I just suddenly felt a lot older. It wasn't even conscious. It just something clicked. I've been writing a project with my writing partner for a long time, and we suddenly stopped that because we were like, how much longer can we flog a dead horse? No one wants it. And we started writing something else that, you know, became really successful as well. And then My Dad Wrote a Porno happened, and then everything kind of slotted into place in a weird way. Yeah, just kind of odd. I just felt ready for it in a way that I don't think if my dad had written the Blinda Blink books, you know, 2 years earlier, I don't think I would have been ready to make My Dad Wrote a Porno. I don't think Alice and James would have been.
When you say you won't be ready, do you think, was that ready confidence-wise or was it platform-wise?
Confidence-wise, skill set-wise, being able to take time off to physically make it, you know, to be financially fortunate enough to be able to do that, to have got my skill set to a point where I felt I could do it on my own, you know, the editing of it, the post-production, all of that sort of stuff. Yeah, just multiple things. You know, Alice had been working in radio for a while by that point, so she kind of understood audio in a way that me and James hadn't. James was, you know, now producing TV shows, so he had a whole other skill set that he didn't have 2 years prior. Like, we all kind of came to the party really equipped to do this thing and make it the best it could be. And I think that's what I mean. I was kind of, my whole life up to that point, I was so impatient to have success. But I had failed to realise that you have to be ready for that success. You know, you actually have to put the work in, get your skill set to a point where it can deliver the success that you feel like you deserve and that you're capable of, because it doesn't just happen like that. I mean, for some people it does, but
and it clicked, and you were around people who also, there's a serendipity there. They were obviously in a similar position where they had time to do it.
Yeah,
can I ask you a practical question? What was the setup? Where did you record it? What software did you edit it? Was it something that
This is sacrilegious, probably, but we recorded it, all of it, in each of our houses. We took it in turns. We tried to make it as social an occasion as possible, so whoever was hosting would like cook dinner and we'd have some drinks and then we'd record. And yeah, we just had we would like bought three mics, really cheap ones. They cost like 200 quid each. And they were on cookbooks, and we recorded it on GarageBand. And then I would edit it on Premiere Pro, which isn't even an audio editing software, but it was the software that I used in my professional work. So I was like, well, I know this software. Why would I use Audition? Even though I'm sure Audition's much better and easier. So it was very lo-fi, and kind of that's how we... I mean, we switched off the fridge. Like, you know, we're not complete charlatans, but... Yeah, it was very lo-fi. But I think that also, we talked about that, you know, because we had access to recording studios if we'd have wanted them. But I think there was something about the show that felt genuine, that we were kind of in a real place and that we were genuinely hanging out as friends. It would have felt slightly sterile, I think, if it had been in a like a BBC sounding studio, you know. So that was a creative choice, believe it or not, as well as a practical one.
Yeah, well, I mean, not only did it click for you personally and Alice and James, you also clicked in terms of the right timing for podcasting, because that's what's so brilliant about it, is the fact that it doesn't need to be a Radio 4 produced thing. Mm. It can be something that you feel like you're a fly on the wall to a conversation.
Yeah.
And the genuine chemistry between you guys hit podcasting at a point where it was, if I can call it, a mainstream way of entertainment, mainstream medium. And it just, everyone kind of bought into this idea that they were along for the ride. Mm. And so when you started that, what was the feedback like? I assume that you had an email address, or was there some kind of way people could get in touch? Were you reading messages?
Yeah, we that was kind of part of the development process, you know, getting all of our social handles and all of that. And yeah, it was kind of instantaneous, really. It was, I think episode 3 was when Elijah Wood tweeted about it, and we were like, oh, people are listening to this elsewhere. I don't know, it just kind of, it sounds so naive. But also podcasting, as you say, it just wasn't what it is now. There weren't any expectations of it. We wanted to make a show. We wanted to make people laugh. That was kind of our only ambition. There was nothing more.
You weren't sat there going, right, well, I'll contact Corporation A.
Yeah, right. And there was no advertising on it, and there was no, you know, and the idea of like a podcast being able to make you, you know, one day tour or have your own TV show. I mean, that just was not even in the ether. So
you weren't thinking, oh, this is a brand.
Right. We weren't. We just were like, well, this is a funny thing that we all enjoy. Maybe other people will enjoy it. You know, I'd been reading this book for people for so long by that point, and everyone just loved it. It was like their favorite little thing. We're like, it was my party piece. And so we were like, well, people seem to enjoy this. Let's make this into a show that we can, you know, share with the world. So it really was kind of that innocent in terms of its conception, but we took it seriously, and we made sure that we had our theme tune commissioned, and we had proper artwork and a photo shoot, and we gave it the best possible chance to be successful, because we all had the experience to do that. But there was no expectation outside of it being a great product. You know, all we really could control was, is this a show that we're proud of and that we think is the best that we can make? Everything else just kind of happened around it, which is why it's lovely when people talk about, you know, it as a huge success. But, you know, I really feel like we had not a huge amount to do with that. And as I said earlier, you know, I have friends who've made incredible stuff that never reached the peaks of porno. And you know, so much of success in our industry is luck. It just is. And timing, and the fact that, you know, we all came at it at a point where we were able to make it the best we could, that my dad had written this book that was as funny as it was at this time, and that podcasting was suddenly having a moment, and... Yeah, even things like technology was at a point where it could be sustained. You know, loads of people had smartphones that they could physically listen to it on the tube, whereas, you know, 10 years earlier, no one had an iPhone. Do you know what I mean? It was just fortuitous, and there was an alchemy to everything. The fact that we as three people worked well on mic together, that, you know, we're friends, but that doesn't always translate, and it just, everything seemed to, and the fact that my dad was okay with it, and my mum was okay with it, and my sisters were okay with it. I was kind of waiting for a point where I was like, is no one going to shut this down? Or is this just going to, okay, we're doing this. And it did feel like we were kind of flying immediately, because everything kind of just slotted into place. And I can't explain that.
I mean, I think there's so many lessons to be learned in what you just said. That it's hard work and it's luck, and I think that's the luck element is often overlooked.
And don't, if you've made something that you're really proud of and it hasn't been immediately successful, it has nothing to do with you. You made a great thing, and if you're proud of it, then that's all that really matters. You know, I always say that to people, you know, what people think of my show is their business. It's nothing to do with me. I'm happy with it. If you don't find it funny, cool. That's okay. Mm-hmm. That's nothing to do with me, you know.
But I also think that you found something that you enjoyed, and being niche isn't necessarily a bad thing, because if it connects with you and your friends, it's going to then project up. And, you know, you found your audience, if I can use a kind of an Americanism, maybe. But it's that thing of, like, you found a connection. And I think a lot of people love that show for that.
Well, it's that thing of, like, someone once said, the most personal is the most universal.
Absolutely.
Because people relate to the intimacy of the truth of what you're telling a story about. And, you know, this couldn't have been more intimate. It's my father, it's my friends, it's, you know, you didn't have to know any of us for it to speak to you, I guess.
We've only got a couple of minutes. So many questions. Could it be a YouTube thing? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. We did think about that, but the visual stuff. Plus, it's more expensive. You know, podcasting is so cheap, you know, on a practical level.
You've got so much going on now. Post My Dad Wrote a Porno, you're back working in theatre.
Stage. It's interesting, isn't it?
In terms of what drives you professionally, is it the same today as it was 15 years ago?
Oh, that's a good question. I hope so. I think so. I think I just want to, like I said, I just want to tell stories. I've never been particularly, like I said before, bothered about how I do that. And I think it's finding the right medium for the right story. And I think I did want to do something completely different post My Dad Wrote a Porno. And I think, you know, having the success that I had with it, you know, a lot of people saying, oh, what's your next podcast going to be? And I was like, I don't really want to do a podcast yet. You know, maybe I will. But I wanted to kind of exercise a different creative muscle, if that makes sense. I felt like I'd kind of done this and I'd done it to the best of my ability. And it was 8 years of my life and it was incredible, but just knackering. And I wanted to kind of do something different. But I think my relationship with, like, success has changed, because I kind of see it for what it is. And actually, success is really personal. It's not about how many people listen to your show or what awards you win. And I know there's a position of privilege to say that, because I have been lucky enough to have all of that. But I think having that gives you the perspective that it's actually the thing that you would think success is going to feed you is never the thing that actually fulfills you. And it's actually, for me, it was making something that I felt really proud of and staying true to the show the whole way through. And also, you know, with My Dad Wrote a Porno, building a show that is could so easily have been like a one-hit wonder, kind of like, oh, that's a funny idea, a couple of episodes, and then just disappears. But to have kind of sustained it and built an audience and made the shows each year was even bigger. And, you know, I think that was the hard part. And so for me now, taking all the stuff that I've learned from My Dad Wrote a Porno and kind of applying it to different mediums is so exciting. But it's just really busy, because suddenly there's a million things that people want you to do and I want to do. And it's about, well, where do you put your energy? Because I was once told by someone that I really respect that a career is a long time, and that you should concentrate on doing something to the best of your ability. And then she said, and then just for a bit, and then do something else, and do that to the best of your ability, and then do so. So it's like you can be spread really thin in this industry, especially when you have success and people want you to do stuff. So it's been more about how do I manage my time, my energy, and what I want to put out into the world, and what are the stories that I want to tell at this point in my life, really.
Jamie Morton and how he became something in media. You can find him on Instagram at Uncle Igor, that's Uncle E-G-O-R, and keep an eye out for Jamie's latest work coming to a streaming platform and theatre near you. How has Jamie carved out such an amazing career? Well, get further insight from our in-house careers advisor via our website at somethingin.media, where you can glean a deeper understanding of what it takes to make it in the world of media, and even the opportunity to book a one-on-one session. You can also find our newsletter sign-up via our website too. Something in Media is a Stable production. And if you enjoyed listening, please follow us by pressing the subscribe button or follow button wherever you get your podcasts. And if you think someone may benefit by listening to these types of stories, please pass on the message. I'm Dave Maguire, and thanks again for listening.